You're listening to the Stone Tapes on Siren 107.3 FM with Sam Stone and friends.
Hello and welcome to the Stone Tapes. I'm Sam Stone and boy, have we got a show for you today. We have in the studio with us today Mr. George Mann. Say hello, George.
Hello, everyone.
And we have David J. Howe, of course.
Hello, hello, hello.
And our lovely Patricia H. Ash, but I'm not going to say it. I'll leave that to Alex to say it at the midweek drive.
Hello.
But yes, we all agree she's a hottie.
She is a hottie.
Oh, right there.
Eight stones for hottie.
So how are you guys? Happy New Year. It's our first show since Christmas.
It is, isn't it? Yes. 2016. Gosh, yes.
I'm still writing 15 on my checks.
Yes.
And it's very foggy out as well, which doesn't bode well for the future. Oh, Patricia, you're going to give us a review again today. Are you going to tell me
yes.
what you're going to review?
So it's a new year and I've already read a book.
Yay.
Several, actually. But the one that we're talking about today is Stardock. And I'm terrible at pronouncing names. So I think the author's name is S.L. Veil?
Yes.
Or Veil?
I would say that.
V-I-E-H-L is how it's spelled. So pronounce that however the correct way is, because I'm going to mess it up. I already have. So, it was really good. Duh. The plot is Dr. Cherry Jo Grayvale is a trauma surgeon.
Doctor who?
Her name is Cherry Jo.
Cherry Jo.
C-H-E-R-I-J-O. I-J-O. Okay. There's an explanation for why her name is that.
Okay.
She's a genetic experiment, and she's named actually after the...
She's a hybrid!
Ah.
sorry, Patricia. I'm second-guessing the book. Come on. Sorry. Go on.
Anyway, Dr. Grayvale discovers a horrible secret, which I've already spilled. She's a genetic experiment, which is illegal in this universe. And so...
Whereas in our one, they're completely allowed.
Well, so far, yeah. We could totally clone a human being, and that would be completely legal, probably.
Yes.
But anyway, she's an illegal genetic experiment. So to escape the clutches of her domineering father / creator, she goes to a remote alien planet named Kevarzangia 2, which I can pronounce, but a five-letter word that's the name of an author. I can't. Don't ask me why. But anyway, so she goes to a remote alien colony, and she brings her cat.
Okay.
Like you would.
Yes.
Sci-fi with a cat. Awesome. Gotta love it. So it's a great medical drama with a lot of really interesting aliens. One of her nurses kind of resembles a praying mantis. Another one looks like a bouquet of flowers. So it's very interesting. There's this sweet little romance that happens, and there's a sentient epidemic.
A sentient epidemic.
I
like it.
Ooh. That's awesome. So I really enjoyed reading this book, and also there's a cat.
Always a plus.
Well, if it's good enough for Alien.
Yeah. Yeah. Aliens, cat. The cat's like the cat likes okay. various aliens. The aliens like the cat. Anyway. So
Do any of the aliens give each other the bunch of flowers?
No.
Yes, this isn't alluding to what the bowl of petunias thought as it plummeted towards the surface of the earth.
You know, maybe.
Maybe it is.
That might be where that the nurse that resembles a bouquet of flowers came from,
okay.
Which would be awesome. Anyway, Cherry Jo is a really fun, spunky narrator. She really cares about her patients. If I were going to be sick in space, I would really want her to be my doctor. So, yeah. I really enjoyed this book. 8 out of 10.
Wow.
Wow.
Fantastic.
Sounds good.
What's it again?
It's called Stardock.
Why is it called Stardock? Is that where they go?
I don't know. Maybe Space Doctor was...
But she's
a
doc.
Oh, Stardock.
Yeah, she's a doc.
Oh, DOC.
Yeah.
Ah, mm-hmm. I see. 8 out of 10.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Sounds like a winner to me.
Mm-hmm. Definitely was.
Yeah.
And that was E.T., Katy Perry. And I love that song, guys. What do you think of it?
Oh, it's one of my favourites. I think it's... I mean, Katy Perry, she's very, very chameleonic and sort of can sound different in every single record that she does. And I think it's a cracking track. And I think it's got an amazing video as well.
I love the video.
If you look it up on YouTube, there's an incredible video for it.
I do love Katy Perry. Her sense of style is really interesting.
Yeah, she's awesome. I think all of her albums. I was just saying to David, you know, the only thing I think about this song that spoiled it slightly is when I think it's Kanye West comes on and there's a rap.
Oh,
on,
yeah.
One version of it, and I think it really takes away from the kind of pop sensibilities of it.
I have to be honest with you, any rap on any song spoils it for me, because
yeah.
As everybody knows, I'm very vocal on the fact that I don't like rap, and it should have a C on the front of it. But then, but then again, I do discount Eminem on that one, because I'm pro-green, I quite like now, actually, so yeah. I'm softening up a little bit.
Yeah, I love candy-coated chocolates.
M&M's. Other ones are available. Well, I'm going to change the mood a little bit here, because we've had some terrible news this week, as I'm sure you're all aware, that we lost one of the music's biggest legends, David Bowie, whichever way you prefer to say it. And, of course, the wonderful and talented Alan Rickman. I just wondered what you guys have any memories at all of and either of these people that you'd like to share with us.
Well, I mean, I've been a Bowie fan for a long, long time. Got, again, all his albums. Listening to him on the way in, actually. But I saw him live 3 times.
Wow.
I was very lucky. And the first time, it's probably the... I tell people it's the most rock and roll thing I've ever done, actually. Because in the 90s, when... Bowie was getting really interested in kind of the internet and how technology was going to affect people. He set up BowieNet, which was kind of it was like an ISP, if you remember the old days where you had to dial into like AOL and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Bowie subscription one, which got you onto the internet, but it was also kind of a fan forum, kind of an official fan forum, and he'd interact
Fantastic.
With the fans a bit on there.
Wow. I never knew he did that.
Yeah, he did it. And I can't really remember how long it lasted, but there was this period, kind of late 90s, early 2000s, and he did a raffle. He decided to put a concert on at the Roseland Ballroom in New York and did a raffle on BowieNet. Said you could put your name in the hat and get tickets. And one of my friends did this, managed to get tickets.
Wow.
And, you know, I was on a bookseller's wage at the time, and I remember the moment sitting at a kitchen table with him and going, should we do it? Go on, we've got tickets to see David Bowie, and it's a fan club only gig.
In New York.
So we did.
I
applied for a new credit card, maxed it out, buying the cheapest flight I could on Air India, and went over for one night. We could only afford one night in the hotel. So we literally flew out there, we had rucksacks, went through customs, got a cab to the venue, saw the gig, went back, had a couple of pints. Next morning we went up the Empire State Building and flew home.
Wow, that's a great
But it was
great.
It was amazing concert as well. Absolutely brilliant.
I just thought, every time you saw Bowie perform, though, and I've never seen him live, but I have always seen recordings of his concerts.
Yeah.
They were just so impressive and so ahead of their time, at that time. Mm. I just loved his music.
He was always ahead of his time, though, and I think that's the beauty of all of these. Again, you're talking about Katy Perry being chameleonic. I mean, David Bowie was almost
a master of
originator
that, isn't he?
Of chameleonic pop.
He reinvented himself constantly.
He reinvented himself constantly. I mean, the one thing that I found out from reading the newspapers when he died, which I never knew, was that the Ziggy Stardust character, his flamboyant Ziggy Stardust character, in 1972, he debuted that at the Red Lion pub in Tolworth.
Oh, wow.
Which is literally walking distance from where I grew up. And I'm like, oh, my goodness me. There's me in 1972 watching John Pertwee and the Sea Devils, and goodness knows what on telly, not realising that Ziggy Stardust was playing a concert within walking distance of my house.
That's absolutely incredible.
I mean, the first time I ever came across him, I was stayed up late. I was about 14, 15. And there was The Man Who Fell to Earth was on television.
Oh, wow.
And I was watching this really shocking film. I'd never seen anything like it. And the next day I went out and looked up his music, and that was how I found his music, which is ridiculous.
It's quite an adult film, isn't it? It's got quite adult themes.
Yeah.
Very strong, very dark film, really. And I'm just completely in love with Space Oddity being the first track that I ever heard of his. Thought it was amazing. Yeah.
Strangely, I really like Laughing Gnome
That's
weird. No, no, it's brilliant.
I like that track. That's great fun. Patricia, have you seen David at all?
The first time I had ever heard of him, actually, we was watching Labyrinth.
Classic. Yes.
Yeah.
One of my favourite films.
We watched that this week.
We did. We did in honour of him.
It had to be done.
Oh, I mean, honestly, if they ever remade that, I think there'd be a huge protest, because how on earth could anyone ever be...
Oh, they can't.
It'd be impossible.
He's the Goblin King. No.
You can't.
You can't. No, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Oh, that's tremendous. And Alan Rickman too, you mentioned.
Yeah, so. Alan Rickman. Oh, do you remember the first time you ever came across Alan Rickman? Was it through Harry Potter or...
Robin Hood. Robin of Sherwood. Not Robin of Sherwood. Robin of Prince of Thieves.
He
was the Sheriff of Nottingham, wasn't he?
Yes, he was wonderful in that.
Good Sheriff of Nottingham. Well, okay. Evil Sheriff of Nottingham, but he was very good at playing that nasty character, and he was fantastic.
And of course, he took that into the Snape character, didn't he? Really, was he a good character or not?
I really liked that about the Harry Potter. Oh, yeah. You were never quite sure of Snape, whether he was or he wasn't. And I think Rickman played it just perfectly.
Yeah. And of course, a very famous role was Truly Madly Deeply, wasn't it, with Juliet Stevenson? Am I right on that one? Do you remember that, Alex? Yeah. One of those things that now I really desperately want to revisit. Yeah. Now that he's passed away, I'd like to go and watch that again.
Yes. And of course, at the moment, I mentioned this to Sam earlier in the week, I'm going down to King's Cross quite a lot at the moment, and they've got a little tribute thing to Alan Rickman on the station. Anyone who goes to King's Cross, you might be interested to know that there's a little area which is called Platform 5 3/4. 9 3/4, and there they've got like half a British Rail trolley stuck in the wall, and they've got Harry Potter scarves, and you can have your photo taken with the trolley going through the wall.
No, it's very cool.
But right next to that, there's like photographs and flowers and bouquets and a big sort of Alan Rickman tribute thing that's slowly building up in the station. So that's really nice.
That just shows you how he's had such an impact.
I have to say that my favourite Alan Rickman role is in Galaxy Quest.
That
is my favourite movie of all time.
It's a great
and
film.
It's because of Alan Rickman.
We will have to schedule that for a film
we'll
of the month.
Yes. that sounds great.
Yes indeed.
Are you interested in video games? If so, be sure to join me, Jake, on the Cyber Den, your weekly dose of tech and games. Treat yourself to the latest news, interviews, some brilliant music, and much more. After all, it is approved by...
me, Duke Nukem.
Kane from Command and Conquer.
Agent 47.
Colonel Roy Campbell.
And more. So join me, Jake, on the Cyber Den. Every Wednesday, 10 till 12.
On Siren FM 107.3.
Favourites, and that was Mysterion.
Oh, yes.
What do you like so much about that one, David?
It's the whole album. It's quite an old album now. It must have been out in the 80s, was it, George-ish?
I think it was late 90s,
late
actually.
Late 90s, was it? Gosh, I'm a bit early. I love it because the voice is just beautiful. I love the music behind. I love the way they kind of mix and scratch and do all that kind of stuff. That particular track, we were just talking about that, and of course it has a theremin on it. And I'm sure, you know, everyone online would suddenly come up with lists, but I was trying to think of any other popular pop music that used a theremin. And it was quite hard to think of anything off the top of your head. But no, I absolutely love Portishead. I think it's a tremendous album. That's from an album called Dummy. And it's just such a brilliant, brilliant album.
Well, we were going to have the lovely Robin Pearce with us today, but unfortunately he is poorly, so he can't be with us. So we're really sorry to not have you this week, Robin. But we are still going to talk about, Robin, the film that everybody's talking about at the moment that Robin was going to review. And unfortunately, David and I still haven't seen it. So I'm wondering, Alex, George, Patricia, you guys have seen the film. Why should we make the effort to go and see Star Wars?
Star Wars. This is Star Wars The Force Awakens.
The Force Awakens, of course. That
Star
one,
Wars
yeah.
The Force Awakens.
Why should we make the effort?
It's spectacle cinema, I think. It's the sort of cinema that you... I guess you... People might... You'll not appreciate me saying this, but it's not the sort of thing you think about too much. You're there for the adventure. You're there for a rip-roaring story that, you know, in the old-fashioned style of adventure story, it's kind of like a Wild West story in space. It really feels like the classic Star Wars to me.
It really does. It depends on how you feel about Star Wars in general as to whether you should go see it or not. I think you should, because I love Star Wars almost as much as I love cats. So,
is there a cat in it?
No.
Ah.
No, there is no cat.
Well, that's
this
a fail then. Major fail.
or a Cherry Joe. There's no Cherry Joe in it either.
No.
Oh, there might.
I'm still recovering from the absence of Jar Jar Binks, personally. Much maligned, much lost, and clearly gone the way of the midichlorians. Never mind.
So what was your take on it, Alex?
I'd give it a 9.5 out of 10 if
really?
I was scoring
wow,
it. I thought
good.
It was very good. I just get concerned with J.J. Abrams because he starts off so strongly, he's so good, but then usually two or three things down the line, like Lost, we sort of think, it just sort of loses it slightly.
He got lost.
Well, I don't think
exactly.
He's doing the next one.
He's not.
Yeah.
No,
he's not doing it.
He's passing the reins on to someone else.
For the second one?
For the second film.
Well, he's obviously realised where he can be. It's interesting, George Lucas has a line about the white slave industry in Disney, which he retracted fairly rapidly. An enjoyable movie, a good movie. But it did revisit an awful lot of the tropes that we loved. I mean, you've got the Death Star, you've got the cute androids, BB-8, you've got the heroic sort of farm girl, you've got various other factors within that. I think word must be given to the cracking British cast, though, because both John Boyega and, indeed, Daisy...
Ridley.
Exactly. Teamwork. It's fantastic, John. I'm just reveling in the fact that finally I get a microphone on the show. But really good from that point of view. Stunning. I thought, they worked extremely well. And from that point of view, as you say, spectacle cinema. Mm. I only saw it as a digital widescreen thing. I didn't see it in 3D. I didn't see it in any of the IMAX things. I can only imagine it could be improved by that as well.
Mm. I mean, I'm actually an original Star Wars fan. I never liked the other films that came after. I only liked the first three.
I
didn't
think
three.
Anybody did.
No.
Yeah.
I always
how
saw that
rude! So to sort of put this in...
The dialogue that George Lucas wrote, the love dialogue is just so wooden in episodes 2 and 3.
Unfortunately, I think Harrison Ford's interrelationship with Carrie Fisher is slightly wooden as well, actually. Mm. Kind of the same kind of genre.
So to put this into context, so that obviously you guys have seen it. So we obviously... The first ever Star Wars film was actually the fourth.
Yes.
And so then we went through 4, 5, 6, so we had those three.
Yes, okay.
Yeah. Then we had the first three, so 1, 2, 3... Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is now number
seven.
Yeah. Oh. So this is going to be 7, 8, 9.
Nine.
So this is number 7.
With a couple of things like Star Wars Rogue Warrior that comes
out. Sure, there were some cartoon ones.
The Clone Wars.
So if you are watching the series, as it were, and now I don't know if any of you guys have done this, what was the third one? Return of the Jedi. So has anyone watched Return of the Jedi and then followed it with this new one to see how it follows on?
Not yet. I did... just watched Return of the Jedi last night.
Right, so you've seen in the other
so
order.
What we did at my house was we went to see the new movie and went, wow, that was awesome. Let's go back and watch all the other ones and then go see this one in the theater again.
Right.
That's what we've been doing.
Okay.
We've gone back
and
seen the other ones.
So have you seen all of them then? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6?
We skipped number one.
You skipped number
one. The Phantom Menace has got one of Qui-Gon Jinn's finest performances. Liam Neeson is legendary.
That bit's fantastic.
I don't remember that bit, but I just remember the Phantom Menace jumping up and down, looking absolutely ridiculous, like a cartoon comic strip.
But that's what Gungans do, of course, Sam. That's what Gungans actually are.
I just thought it was so bad, I don't even remember seeing the end. I might have walked out of the cinema. I can't remember.
This is in a different league,
Sam. If you didn't see the end of the Phantom Menace, you kind of missed out on one of the most fantastic duels, I think, of anything ever. Mm.
Maybe we're torturing ourselves with it again, then.
Just see that part.
So when they finish the next three, we'll buy the 9-film box set, and then we'll watch it.
From start to finish.
That sounds amazing, actually.
On fast forward.
Through the first three.
So, Star Wars then Force Awakens. So, Alex, 9.5.
Yeah, 9.5. Not quite a full 10 for me, because I felt that... there were certain things which I thought were manipulative, but that, what do we expect? It's Disney. It adds to Disney's coffees, exactly. Yeah.
So, I think they were skillfully manipulative. I think there was enough new stuff, and I think the new characters are just absolutely fantastic. And I think Disney has really hit the nail on the head. And I say 10 out of 10.
10 out of 10.
Wow.
Definitely. George?
I think I'm with Alex. I'd say 9.5. I saw it 3 times at the cinema, and by the end of the 3rd time, you're starting to see, you know, the slight tweaks that you...
The construction
thing. Exactly that.
You see the flaws after a while, don't you?
They're minor. They're really minor, but they're there. So I'd go with the 9.5 as well, I think.
All right, fantastic.
Well, I think with a recommendation like that, it sounds like we ought to give it a try, David, and maybe cinema is the best place for it.
Maybe.
Beyond the mind, the empty space that circles time. I see where others stumble blind. The secret truth they never find. Eternal wisdom is my guide. I am the Doctor. Through cosmic waste the TARDIS flies, to taste the secret source of life. A present science can't deny exists within, outside, behind the latitude of human minds. I am the Doctor. My voyage dissects the course of time. Who knows, you say, but are you right? Who searches deep to find the light that glows so darkly in the night? Toward that point, I guide my fleet. As fingers move to end mankind, metallic teeth begin their grind. With sword of truth, I turn to fight the satanic powers of the night. Is your faith before your mind? Know me, am I the Doctor?
Ah, and that, of course, for the Doctor Who fans in the room, which is quite a lot of them, was, of course, John Pertwee with Who is the Doctor? And, of course, I introduced the lovely George Mann earlier, but I didn't explain who he is. But, of course, you all know who he is because he is the best-selling author of the Doctor Who book, Engines of War. Hello again, George.
Hello.
I'd like to have a chat to you, if that's okay, about what you've been up to recently.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, it must have been quite a thrill for Engines of War to become such a huge success.
I'm still reeling from it, to be honest. It's obviously the best, the book that sold the best that I've written, and I think I've done 11 or 12 novels now, and it really just took off. And I don't think that's down to me really. I think that's down to the fact it captured a moment in Doctor Who history. It was a book about John Hurt and the Daleks and the Time War, and the first and only one so far. And you know, hopefully, I gave people a story that they enjoyed, and it built, and it's continued to build. And people, you know, I'm still every time I do a signing or an event or something for any book, there are always people in the queue with Engines of War.
I'm sure there's lots of people out there who'd be interested to know in how you became involved in the world of Doctor Who. Because I get asked this all the time at events myself, actually, is how did I get to write a Doctor Who? And I'm sure when we all know the answer to that, we'll be able to do it.
I was very lucky, really, with Doctor Who. The first official Doctor Who thing I wrote was a short story for the old Big Finish Short Trips anthologies. It was luck in that instance. Someone introduced me to an editor who was putting together a short story collection. Said, you know, George is a huge fan, and I was just starting to write, really, at the time. And he said, well, pitch me a story, and took it from there, and I managed to get that story in there. And then nothing for a while, until actually a bit of serendipity. The range editor, Justin Richards, was obviously aware of my Newbyn Hobbs books that I'd been writing, which, you know, are heavily influenced by Doctor Who, amongst other things. And I'd reconnected with an old friend who worked at Faber and Faber. Justin was writing for Faber and Faber, and literally the week before, I'd seen this old friend, Catherine. I'd given her a copy of The Affinity Bridge, and then she'd bumped into Justin at a Faber event. And he said, oh, what are you reading? She said, oh, I'm reading a book by one of my friends, George Mann. It's called The Affinity Bridge. And Justin said, oh, he's your friend. I've been trying to find out how to get hold of George.
Wow.
I wonder, you know, his Newbery and Hobbs books suggest that it'd be perfect for writing for a Doctor Who, for a novel. So she connected us and took it from there. And I wrote an 11th Doctor novel for BBC Books, Paradox Lost. And then from that point, really, everything opened up and I started talking to BBC Books a bit more regularly, and some audios and the comics.
Oh, fantastic. So you've done some comics. Tell us a little bit about what you've done in the comic comic world?
So, bits and bobs. I started, well, Titan published my novels, my Newbery and Hobbs novels, and they really, I got in at the ground. They were opening their Titan Comics imprint. They've always been involved heavily in magazine publishing, but they wanted to get into the American comic market. And it was just around the time that I was talking to them about a new series of Newbery and Hobbs books. And I said to them, you know, I love comics. Is there an opportunity to write some Newbery and Hobbs comics? And they said, yeah, absolutely. Let's put a pitch together. So I did, and sold that to them, a four-issue comic, which has yet to come out, actually. It's been a few years in the making.
Fantastic.
Wonderful artist called Dan Boltwood, and he's really taking his time crafting every single page of it. So all the scripts have been done for a long time. It's probably coming this year. But having written those and kind of found that I really enjoyed writing comics, I kind of said to Titan, oh, I'd love to do more if the opportunity is there. And this was just around the time Engines of War just hit. They just got the license to do Doctor Who comics, and the three things came together, basically.
That's so brilliant.
They offered me the chance to do some 12th Doctor fill-in comics, first of all. I did a couple of standalones, and then on the back of that, an 8th Doctor miniseries, bringing Paul McGann back.
Wow. Oh, that's... Ooh. Oh, well, we love Paul McGann. Yeah. We do. The process of writing a comic, though, obviously, you're normally a novelist.
Yep.
Or a short story writer, or you have done audios. Is it very different from doing...
Yeah, it's really different from writing prose.
How would you approach it?
Wow. Okay, so the biggest lesson I learned, the difference between writing prose and writing a comic, is all of the action happens between the panels. So you're not describing the action, you're describing the cause and effect.
Ah, interesting.
So, you know, someone punches someone.
I'm making notes here.
You're showing, you're showing someone swinging their fist, and then you're showing someone reeling back.
Yeah.
That's a really kind of a series of snapshots. And you've got to be really economical, because obviously, you know, an average comic is 20 to 22 pages. So to tell a whole story in that is quite constrained, but I think it makes it a tight story as well. You know, you've really got to think carefully about what you're putting on every page.
So do you like map out the frames? I mean, you produce, do they call it a script, is it?
I write a script. To be able to write the script and put the descriptions in for the artist...
You have to have some idea.
I draw stick figures. I cannot draw for Toffee. I really wish I could, but I can't. But I map out, even if it's just a grid, where I go, right, box one, panel one, this is what's going to happen. Mm. Panel two, this is what's going to happen. And map it through. And, you know, you pick up some, from reading a lot of comics and talking to other comic creators, you pick up some rules, like, you know, you probably only want about six panels on a page, max, in most instances.
And don't they have to follow in a kind of, like, an order, unless you're going to be very clever.
Or something. Absolutely. There's got to be a logical progression to the way the story unfolds. Yes. But a good artist will help with all of that, and I think that's one of the other really interesting things about it, is that although you might conceive a comic and conceive a script and a story and be the first person to commit it to the page, it's not yours. It's yours and the artist's.
Collaborative.
It's really collaborative.
Very collaborative. Yeah,
absolutely. Because they do the heavy lifting at the end of the day. You know, it might take me 3 days, a week to write a script. It's going to take an artist weeks and weeks to craft those pages, and they're the ones who they have the kind of the visual ideas, and they'll make sure that the story's flowing. And, you know,
but you have to make sure in your scripts that you've mentioned anything that you require to be significant.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know if the whole story revolves around him having a magnetic yo-yo, you have to tell them that he's got a magnetic yo-yo at the beginning, kind of thing.
Absolutely. That. Yeah. No, that's really true. Yes. And I mean, it's quite liberating in a lot of ways because you're writing for the artist. So the only thing that's actually from your page, the only thing that's going to appear for the end customer, in reader, is the dialogue. Mm-hmm. So you actually can put loads and loads of stuff in parentheses and just say, remember, he's got a magnetic yo-yo, and this is going to happen, and this scene's like the opening scene in Star Wars. Don't forget, blah, blah, blah. Yes. You can use all of those cues.
Yeah.
And then what comes back is usually...
make you go, wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. You work with an artist like Emma Vicelli, who's doing the 8th Doctor comics, and she'll add panels and take panels away to...
So she'll adjust it.
She'll keep the integrity of the story, she'll keep the flow of dialogue. Yeah. But she'll tweak it to better tell the story. It's about having an impact, and it's one of the best parts of the day when a folder pops up.
So
email.
Sounds like you're quite proud of the comics.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying them a lot, and it's It's, I mean, I love writing prose. I'll never stop writing novels, but it's been quite hard actually to switch gears back because I've been writing, you know, a whole bunch of comics, and now I'm in novel land again.
Which is a lot harder work in some ways, because of all the detail you've actually got to draw in now with an, as a novelist.
So what is it you're working on at the moment then in the novels? Is it there's another Newbery and Hobbs, or is it?
There's a Newbery and Hobbs that's just about finished. I'm doing two actually. Oh, yeah. So the Newbery and Hobbs just about finished, and there's a new novel in the Ghost series as well, which is my other kind of 1920s.
Wow. So explain to people what Newbery and Hobbs is.
Newbery and Hobbs is if you imagine a mashup of Sherlock Holmes, Doctor Who, and Steven Peele. You kind of got a bit of a and Hammer Horror maybe.
It's all my
influences pulled together really. Mm-hmm. When I first, it's a Victorian fantasy mystery series really. With it's kind of it's got the framework of crime and crime stories really, mystery stories, but they've always got a fantastical or supernatural element to them.
And steampunk element. Who are Newbery and Hobbs?
So Newbery, Sir Maurice
Hobbs
Newbery.
Is a giant. Tiger,
cat. No. Yeah. So Maurice Newbery is a gentleman investigator for the Crown. He works at the British Museum. That's he's like an anthropologist. It's his day job, as it were. But he's gentry. He's mm-hmm. And he works for the Queen. And his assistant, Miss Veronica Hobbs, is really actually the. Largely the brains behind the outfit,
as always.
and as you find out in the first novel, she's actually an agent for the Queen as well. And there's a bit of a thing going on there. You know, the Queen's brought her in to keep an eye on Newbery.
And which is the first novel? What's the first?
The Affinity Bridge is the first novel.
And I think
I just read that last week. It was fantastic. I really enjoyed
you very
it.
Much.
Is it steampunk as well? Would you say it was a bit?
I would classify it as steampunk. Probably because of the ground trains.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, it tends to get classified as steampunk. And people always ask me, you know, why did you start writing steampunk? And I'm not sure I classify it as steampunk. Not because I've got any issue with steampunk, but there's not much punk in it. There's a lot of steam. and I think that's the thing that always strikes me about steampunk. It's kind of, there's a political and a fashion movement there as well. And I think what I've done is pilfered the aesthetic and put it into my stories because I love it.
I would say Veronica is Miss Hobbs is rather punk. She has some progressive views.
She does actually, yeah. That's a fair chance.
Is she a snappy dresser?
She tends to wear culottes rather than long skirts, so she can go and fight.
So she's different.
She's a modern woman in the Victorian age, I suppose.
Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
8, 7, 6.
Commencing countdown, engines on. Check ignition and may God's love be with you. This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade, and the papers want to know. Now it's time to leave the capsule if you dare. This is Major Tom to ground control. I'm stepping through the door, and I'm floating in a most peculiar way, and the stars look very different today. For here am I sitting in a tin can, far above the world.
Of course, that was Space Oddity, one of my favourite songs by David Bowie. And back to George. We were talking very briefly there about what your plans are for the future. What are you up to at the moment?
I've got loads coming this year, actually. Some more comics. You obviously talked about comics. Just announced a mini-series based on Dark Souls, a kind of fantasy video game.
Oh, fantastic.
And a whole bunch more Doctor Who as well, some more 8th Doctor, some more 12th Doctor. The new Nubian Hobbs and Ghost novels that I mentioned. And hopefully making some forays into TV work as well.
And, of course, there's a Sherlock book in there somewhere as well,
yes,
as I recall.
Yes, of course, there is indeed. Sam, well remembered. Yes, there's an anthology of new Sherlock Holmes stories, which I've edited, put together. Sam's written an excellent story for. Along with a whole gang of great authors. I'm not sure what the actual release date of that one is off the top of my head.
But, no, but I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Towards the end of the year.
So you're going to be... When do you sleep? You know?
Yeah, February.
February. March, April.
Yeah.
And just before we move on to talk about the film of the month, what would you really... Is there anything that you'd like to do that's on your bucket list and you haven't done yet?
Oh, blimey. The TV writing is a definite, and I have to, before I die, I have to write a story with Spider-Man in it.
Oh, wow,
yeah,
cool.
I'm a huge Spider-Man fan, always have been.
Oh, cool.
So one day.
One day.
One day.
I can see that happening, yes. That coming your way.
Yeah, keep
Thank
trying.
You. Yes. Thank you, George.
That's
Thank
awesome.
You.
And actually, we're going to talk about a movie now that George recommended to David and I, and I'll let David take it away.
I was just going to say that, darling, that... Yes, the film that we're looking at today, George recommended this to us over Christmas, and so we dug it out and had such a good time watching it that we thought, yes, we've got to do this. So it's called The Earth Dies Screaming. So it's a fantastic black and white science fiction film. So it's quite hard to explain in a way. It's sort of a chap returns from a space mission, and it's a bit Planet of the Apes-y, isn't it? He kind of arrives on Earth, but everyone's gone. The whole place is deserted. Everything's disappeared.
Everyone's dead.
Everyone's dead, basically. And he sort of drives around a bit and then finds some survivors and they kind of all get together in a nice little pub.
Village pub,
very convenient, a nice little village pub. It was fantastic.
That's the best place to get together,
absolutely,
isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And then they kind of realise that I think the radio doesn't work and they can't get hold of people and all this stuff. And then they see these kind of strange... What I think they initially think they're people in spacesuits wandering around, but there's some lovely, lovely shots, and you see that they're actually sort of robot machine type people. And George, you'd said to us, they're Cybermen.
Yeah, they're like proto.
It's like the proto Cybermen have invaded the Earth, and they're wandering around with. Have they got ray guns? I can't remember. They touch people, don't they? They disintegrate.
Ray hands.
Yeah.
And this group of people, of course, they have arguments. Some of them run off. They get killed. They get touched by the aliens, as it were, by their ray hands and die. It's a tremendous film. 1964 it was made, and what's particularly interesting about it is it's almost like the Hammer film that got away, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
Directed by Terence Fisher, and writer was Harry Spalding as Henry Cross. I'm not quite sure who he was. And we're looking at a cast of Willard Parker, Virginia Field, Dennis Price, who's always good value. Mm-hmm. I was very impressed to see Thorley Walters playing Thorley Walters again.
Yeah. Always.
As the Burgermeister.
Yes. Hammer is not a hammer unless he's in it, I just think.
And David Spencer was in it, and that was a name that I recognised, and you said, who's David Spencer? And I had to explain that David Spencer was in Doctor Who. He was in the Abominable Snowmen story, playing one of the monks in the... in the monastery. In
and
the
I should
Patrick
have known
channel.
When I said who was he,
you
that it was definitely
that.
Somebody to do with Doctor Who.
So that was expensive. But yeah, it's a great, fun, sort of black and white Hammer film that isn't a Hammer film.
Yeah.
That looks in a way slightly ahead of its time. And I kind of quite enjoyed it, except for the fact that it doesn't end.
Just stops.
It just stops. It just stops. So as long as you kind of can go with the fact that it just stops.
Yeah, you never get a proper resolution. They kind of head off
in an aeroplane, don't they, I think, at the
that's
end?
Right, yes.
Yeah, that's
to,
right,
to go and look for other survivors, and that's where it
it's
starts.
It's a bit random.
Yeah.
You know, that suddenly this disparate group of people can fly an aeroplane.
Well, the
isn't he
the
a pilot,
first guy
the guy,
we see,
the
he's a pilot.
Guy.
Oh.
I think
he's
in the
so,
air.
I mean, that explains the airplane.
There's a gas attack at the start, isn't there, that kills most of the
right.
people.
That's right. It's a bit Midwich Cuckoos, as you said, didn't you, Sam? Mm. It's a bit like Midwich Cuckoos, with all these bodies lying
yeah,
around.
And I think there's a whole sequence at the start, which is just almost silence, and just seeing people dropping off trains and collapsing in their cars, and cars swerving into posts. And I think it's quite eerie, really, that bit.
It reminds me, of course, Doctor Who, of the invasion, when the cyber signal comes through, and everybody starts falling over and collapsing in that Doctor Who story.
I think that there's a lot in that story which feels to me like it could have influenced Doctor Who, the whole village under siege, the whole, you know, the Cybermen element to it. It really felt like it was the setup for a 60s Doctor Who serial.
Yes.
I thought one of the really clever things as well for a film of that time was the fact that they had people who had apparently died leaning against things, and you know, one of them I think was on a window ledge, and it was just all so beautifully decorated in that way because you go, well, they really thought about that. Somebody could just die in that position,
and of course, people die and
really
come
clever.
Back as like white-eyed
like
zombies,
zombies
as well.
Yeah, when they're killed by the robots,
killed by robot ray hands.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What did you think of it, Patricia?
I really liked seeing the different personalities reacting to the situation. I mean, one guy just completely gives up and starts drinking all the booze inside.
That's tremendous.
That'd be me.
Oh, it's a great film. It's a great film. So I think, what should we give this one? I mean, I'd probably give it about 7 out of 10.
I
probably
would say 8 out of 10.
Yeah, I'd go with the 8 as well, I think.
Sam?
Yeah.
I'm going to split the difference, 7.5.
Okay, so that's The Earth Dies Screaming. Go and seek it out.
It's worth a watch.
Film lovers.
It definitely is worth a watch. Oh, well, I'd like to say huge, huge thanks to George for coming in today, making
Thank
such
you
a
very
massive
much.
Effort yes. in this very, very
cold wintry,
and
misty.
And misty, very misty Lincolnshire at the moment. Thank you so much to Patricia, as always, great review, and to David.
Thank you.
And, of course, to our wonderful producer, Alex Lefchuk. We'll speak to you next time.